Hey everybody, and welcome to the Hack My Homestead podcast. I am back and better than ever, I guess you would say, back from the family trip out to Salt Lake City. We got dumped on. We got 4 inches of snow while we were out there skiing. Probably the best ski trip we've ever done. We do an annual trip with our daughters, and this is the last one before my older daughter goes out and into the world as an adult and tries to do her thing. So it ended up being just a really, really great trip, and we are just super grateful that we were able to get that done. So I'm back. Today is Tuesday, March 14th. I was intending on getting a video, or rather a podcast, out to you guys yesterday, but just had a bunch of work stuff I was trying to get caught up on, and just wasn't able to make it happen. So getting this out today, and we'll have a full week. I'll go ahead and do Tuesday through Friday this week. I've got a little bit of, I call it listener feedback, that I'll do at the end of the week. And then I've got some, what I consider to be decent content for the early part of the week. Today, I'm going to start off with the Silicon Valley Bank failure, and why that happened, in my opinion. And you're hearing a whole lot of stuff from both the left and the right on what happened. Oh, the regulators failed. Oh, it's, you know, environmental issues that, you know, they're not investing in the right things. And I've seen people say, oh, it's because they had an all-female investment team, and, you know, and so they were more concerned with diversity than they were with actual competence. And while all of those things might have some piece to play in it, in my opinion, the primary culprit here is the Federal Reserve. So if you look at what caused the bank run, the run on the bank when depositors pulled out $42 billion is what caused the actual collapse. But what caused that? Why did all these depositors make a run on the bank and try to pull their money out? I got news for you. Any bank that has $42 billion worth of liquidity pulled out of it in a very short period of time is going to have problems. Obviously, bigger banks are going to be able to take that kind of hit better than smaller banks, but $42 billion is not, they don't just have $42 billion in cash laying around, you know, that they can take out of circulation, so to speak, and keep on operating. So, you know, if we look at what happened here, there was some deregulation, right? So, this bank was in the, under $50 billion worth of deposits range, and that was the limit for the stress tests. During the Trump administration, that limit was raised to $250 billion. And guess what happened? They bounced up to $250 billion worth of assets. So, you know, there's probably more information that's going to come out of this thing as the regulators go through. But the reality is that you had a batch of deposits that were non-interest-bearing deposits. You had another batch of deposits that were interest-bearing deposits. And typically what a bank will do with, they're not going out here and buying Bitcoin, okay? They're going out here and they're buying treasuries. Well, treasuries are only valuable if the rate stays the same or goes down. And if the rate goes up like it has been on a pretty regular basis for, call it, the past 9 months, the bonds that you bought 6 months ago when the rate was 2% are not worth as much, because why would you pay face value for a bond that pays 2% when bonds that you can buy today are paying 4% or 6%? And so what happened is that you had all these assets that the bank had to pay interest on. And so they have to have some sort of way to get the money to pay that interest. And typically the way a bank operates is it will buy things that deliver a higher interest rate, and then it delivers the lower interest rate, and the arbitrage between those two numbers becomes the profit for the bank, right? Real simple. I buy something that pays me 3%. I pay you 2%. I make 1% on it as long as your money's in the bank, right? So it's not rocket science. But what happens is that when the Fed raises the interest rate And let's not beat around the bush here. The Fed raised the interest rate to combat inflation that was caused by massive government spending. I'm not going to place the blame for massive government spending on any one group, but that's why we had inflation. When you have the government pumping trillions of dollars into the economy, it's going to create inflation, regardless of what you spend that money on. People, you know, oh, it's infrastructure. Oh, it's keeping small businesses, whatever. It doesn't matter. The reasoning does not matter. What you say you were doing with the money doesn't matter. When you put that much money into circulation, it's going to cause inflation. Because if there's a limited number of things and there's more money to buy those things, then the person who's willing to spend the most money gets the thing. And when they buy that thing, the next thing is more expensive. Because why? There's less of them now. And so, you know, there's a natural equilibrium in any market that gets formed between what people are willing to pay for a thing, what how much is produced based on what the market is willing to pay, and then how the producers price those things, right? And those prices are based on inputs, and they're based on profitability and marketing expenses and things like that. But at the end of the day, there's a natural equilibrium that gets set in any market. Here, people are willing to pay 50 cents for a roll of toilet paper, and toilet paper manufacturers are willing to create a million rolls of toilet paper a year as long as they're able to sell them for 50 cents, right? So that's how it works. Well, when you have supply chain issues, well, now maybe there's only 900,000 rolls of toilet paper being made where there used to be a million because two shift supervisors got COVID and weren't allowed to go to work for 14 days or whatever the case may be, right? So there's a slight disruption in supply. People get crazy and say, oh my gosh, I got to stock up on toilet paper. And while normally I might not be able to stock up on toilet paper, I've have all this government money that was handed to me for existing. And so now I've got money to buy 20 rolls of toilet paper at a time instead of 10. Well, you start seeing people buy 20 rolls of toilet paper at a time. Retailers turn around and say, hey, maybe we should bump the price of this toilet paper up to 75 cents. Okay, let's bump it up to 75 cents. And then people with free money show up and they're still buying 20 rolls of toilet paper at 75 cents a roll. Well, now you've got other manufacturers saying, well, wait, at 75 cents a roll, we're willing to make more toilet paper. We're willing to make toilet paper, period. But it takes a lot of time to ramp up new production. And so while their thought process might be, as long as toilet paper is being sold for 75 cents a roll, we can make as much as possible. We can roll up and you know, add new paper machines and things like that. That's a multi-year process for that to happen. So what happens? Price of toilet paper stays at 75 cents a roll because you never get that additional production to increase the supply to drive that equilibrium back down closer to 50 cents. And now everyone's comfortable with paying 75 cents a roll. Well, okay, what happens when people start paying $1 a roll? You see what I'm saying? What I'm saying is that the price of commodities naturally sets an equilibrium. And when that equilibrium is impacted by either issues on the supply side of money or on the supply side of the thing, that creates inflation. It can also cause deflation, but typically it causes inflation. It causes the price to go up. We all get used to paying it. We adjust other pieces of our spending habits, or in the event, we have wage inflation, we have government spending, how can I afford to give my employees a big raise to keep them? Well, number one, I can't afford for them to leave for $3 an hour to go to my competition, so I got to pay them more money. But, and you know what? That doesn't hurt that much because the government just broke me off $26,000 per employee, whether my business was impacted or not, or whether my business was financially impacted or not, right? So you got all these different dynamics in play creating inflation. And it's all because the government put extra money in. And what do we have? What do we have? We have the Fed stepping in saying, we've got to put a stop to this or it will never stop. People will demand more money to work, which means they have more money to pay for the goods, which drives the cost of the goods up, right? Because now there's less of those goods available. which makes the people require more money to work because now I have to have more money. You know, now the landlord wants more money because, well, paint's more expensive and that water heater that I had to replace is more expensive. And I, when I put the new roof on the apartment complex, it's more expensive. So I got to charge more. Well, now the employees have to make more money, and on and on and on and on it goes. So the Fed steps in and says, hey, we have to put a stamp, you know, transitory was the term at first. Oh, yeah, this is just transitory. It's going to go away. That was ridiculous. You don't put $3 trillion worth of new money in the economy and have transitory inflation. And so what happens is they finally said, okay, maybe it's not transitory. Maybe we have to do something about this. Let's start raising the rates. And the rates that they're raising are the rates that it costs banks to borrow money from each other, right? Or it's the rate that treasury bonds are issued at. So what are treasury bonds going to pay? Well, this does a lot of different things. One of the things it does is it makes investment in the stock market more risky. Why is it more risky? Well, if a bond's paying 1%, then in order to get a 2% return on my money, I've got to look somewhere other than bonds, which means all of the money that used to be in bonds at, call it 4 or 5%, are now in the stock market, or they're in real estate, or they're in real estate investment trusts, right? So what does this do? Well, this creates a stock market bubble. It drives the price of everything in the stock market up, or not everything, but at least a lot of things in the stock market get driven up because there's no safe alternative. You know, for the past 10 years, your safe alternative was a dividend paying stock. That's what the, you know, the dogs of the Dow. That's what everyone was saying. Oh, you're not making any money off of bonds anymore. Put your money in the dividend paying stocks. So what does that cause? It causes the price of the dividend paying stocks to be higher than they otherwise would be. Because if I can get a 4% return with a bond, and a 4% return is acceptable to me, and maybe it's not my total portfolio, but it's acceptable for 25% of my portfolio, well, then I'm going to put that money in bonds. And so bringing it all the way back around to SVB, you have all these deposits. A portion of those deposits are bearing interest, and another portion of those deposits are for things like making payroll. Well, guess what? If those companies have a higher interest rate for their lines of credit, you know, my line of credit interest rate was 3% 2 years ago. Well, maybe I'll leave that money in the bank. I'll pull some money off my line of credit to make payroll, and then I'll get my accounts receivables paid down, and then I'll pay off that line of credit, right? Why take cash out of the bank if I can just lean on my line of credit, right? So a lot of these companies were doing this, particularly, you know, growth companies and companies that are the type of customers that would be doing business with Silicon Valley Bank. Well, when the rates go up, two things happen, right? I already described what happens to the price of those bonds that they bought that were 2% bonds. Well, they're not worth what they used to be because no one's going to pay for that bond when they can get one paying double the interest. The other thing that happens is that now when people are putting my money into my bank, they're demanding a higher interest rate. So I can't use those 2% bonds to pay when I've got a 3% interest rate that I have to offer in order to be competitive with the other banks and what they're offering on their savings accounts. So, and then the third thing is, I touched on it earlier, you've got people pulling cash out because they have to make payroll, they have to buy things, and they're not relying on credit to do that. They're relying on cash to do that now. So those three things work together to make Silicon Valley Bank's balance sheet look really bad. But those bond losses don't really matter until you have to sell them, right? You don't have to mark the price for those bonds down. All you do is pray that one day the rates will come back down before those bonds have to be sold, and you can either roll them over or you can find, you know, the next sucker to buy them. Or maybe you have a really profitable quarter on a different piece of the business and you take losses on some of those bonds, you know, that are coming, or you feel like maybe they're coming, or maybe we got just too much of them to keep that risk on the balance sheet. And so you decide, hey, I'm going to go ahead and sell these bonds at 85% of market value in order to, you know, take them off my balance sheet. even though I'm not required by law to do it, because technically you don't have the loss until you sold the bonds. But when you've got people pulling cash out and you've got other people showing up saying, hey, you know what? I'm closing my account. I got $5 million in the bank here. I heard that you guys are sitting on $44 billion worth of liability related to your bonds, and I'm not comfortable with that level of risk. I'm pulling all my money out. Well, what do you have to do? Again, you're not sitting. You don't have $40 billion worth of cash sitting in the vault in the back. It's all digital. It's all rolled up into other things. A lot of it's rolled up into bonds. Not risky investments. They're not out here playing, they're not putting all your money on number 17 at the roulette table or on let's roll a yo on craps, right? These are good investments. All they're doing is saying, I need something that's going to pay 3% so that I can pay 2% in this account. Or I need to get something that's going to pay 4% so I can pay 3% in this account, right? That's how all that works. But when people start showing up saying, I want my money, give me my money right now, well, what happens? In order to fund that demand, they have to now sell those bonds. And so that's what really caused the bank run is, all right, I've got to sell these bonds at a loss. So I've got to sell $6 million of the bonds, for example, to create $5 million worth of money to close out this account. Well, that happens, word gets out, and then it's a run on the bank. And so now you've got all of these liabilities that the differential between what they're worth and what they were bought for was literally created by the Federal Reserve raising these interest rates. And you end up with the run on the bank, and then the regulators step in and say, okay, well, you've got negative $2 billion. And we can't allow that to happen. So FDIC is now going to pay all of these accounts that were $250,000 and below, or the bottom $250,000 of a lot of these accounts. And then they're going to say, hey, this could be a systemic risk, so we're going to pull from this other fund that banks pay into. And this is not taxpayer money. Now, the reality is that once this happens, you could potentially end up with even higher interest rates, which impacts all of the taxpayers. It's a tax that they don't really call a tax. But in terms of the actual dollars, it's not like 2008, 2009, when you had literally taxpayer dollars being written and checks handed to banks to bail them out, and then a significant amount of new money created so that troubled assets could be bought from the balance sheets of those banks. You know, this is not that. This is a different problem. This problem was created by government rather than government just creating the ability for the problem to exist like they did with the 08 financial crisis. I don't think this is going to result in a massive liquidity issue. I think that they're going to step in. I think that there's probably going to be some other banks that you're going to have, if not similar issues with. I mean, look, the reality is that anybody, person, company, or bank that bought a bond when they were next to nothing because they were paying a little bit and they were less risky than the stock market, those bonds are worth less today than they were 3 months ago, 6 months ago, 9 months ago. That's everything. That has nothing to do with a risky investment. That has to do with you chose what you thought was a low-risk investment, and the Federal Reserve said, hey, we don't care about what you think. We've got to tamp this inflation that was caused by the government down, and the only way that we have to do that is by raising the interest rates. So I don't think this is going to be as widespread problem, but I do think that you're going to have smaller banks where maybe even credit unions where people are going to look at the balance sheet, and if there's more bonds with unrealized losses, if there's a significant amount of unrealized losses related to bonds that are bearing a lower interest rate than what you have currently, you could see this happen at other places because they're like, okay, well, it happened at SVB. Why wouldn't it happen at this bank? I better go get my money out while I still can. And that's why the president and Janet Yellen are coming on and saying, hey, this is not a liquidity crisis. This is not risky investment. This is a specific issue with a specific bank. And while this problem might be replicated in other areas, it's not a systemic issue. And of course, I could be totally wrong on that. 3 months from now, we may be saying, hey, remember back when we had banks in the U.S. and we used dollars? That was a fun time, wasn't it? But from what I've read and from what I've listened to, trying to be as open-minded as possible and understanding what the Federal Reserve is doing, what they do, I don't think this is a massive problem. So I'll wrap it up with that today. Thank you guys for joining me. Thank you for being patient last week while I was out. Hope to get some really good content out to you guys this week. And as always, you can email me at Sean, S-H-A-W-N at hackmyhomestead.com. If you have any questions, comments, or things you'd like for me to talk about on the show. Thanks, and we'll talk to you next time.